It is 25 minutes after the hour. It is a therapeutic Thursday, now theological Thursday, because we're joined by Pastor Robbie Pruitt. Robbie is an Anglican pastor, lives in and has his church in Virginia. Robbie, good morning. How are things out east?
Good morning, Jim. Good to be with you. No, we don't have David with us, but just the two of us.
Yeah,
love it.
The two of us. That was a song, I think, from a movie. I think that was it. So we got Mark 4 on our minds today, and I've got to fess up here. I've probably spent less time in the book of Mark than any other gospel. That doesn't mean I'm totally ignorant of it, but it always reads to me like a diary or a transcription of a diary, or maybe just a bunch of cliff notes, you know, that it's just a bunch of things strung together that are informative but don't really provide a comprehensive narrative, although it changes a little bit when you get to Mark 4. But Mark 3, for example, this has always disturbed me. Then Jesus entered a house, and again a crowd gathered, so that he and his disciples were not even able to eat. When his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him, for they said, he is out of his mind.
Yeah.
That's like a total non sequitur. What do we make of that?
Yeah, I just addressed this exact passage last Sunday on June the 9th at our church, at our 9 o'clock service. It's a perplexing passage, especially if you grew up Catholic, because if you grew up Catholic, you grew up thinking Jesus didn't have any brothers or sisters.
Yeah.
And here is mentioned brothers and sisters.
That's because Mary was supposedly a perpetual virgin, right?
Right. So here you see mother, brothers, and sisters. And the way that that's kind of addressed from the Catholic perspective is this is kinspeople. Or these are Joseph's children from a previous marriage. And there's nothing in the Bible at all to support that this is somehow a second marriage and that Joseph is older. We don't hear a lot about Joseph, so that implies that he could have died of old age or an ailment of some kind.
It's not unusual for an older man to marry a very young girl. That was the culture.
It isn't unusual, but it would be unusual for them not to have a marital relationship and children. I mean, that would have been really unusual. And we know that the scriptures tell us that Joseph did not know Mary until after she had given birth. And that word there, to know, is he didn't have any sexual relationships with her until after Jesus was born. So it's not that she is perpetually a virgin necessarily, according to my Protestant beliefs and views and reading of the scripture, but that she was a virgin when she conceived Jesus. Mm-hmm. And here we see it twice, this mention in Mark chapter 3, we see twice mention of his family. And in some translations, it's not just any home, it's his home. When Jesus came to his home, which opens up a whole nother, you know, can of worms, so to speak, that I thought that Jesus said, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. I thought that was what Jesus said about where he lived.
You know, my assumption was this was in Capernaum, but now it makes more sense to think it was probably in Nazareth. It doesn't specify. It does tell you that the teachers of the law who had come down from Jerusalem, meaning coming down from the mountaintop there to a lower altitude, so it could have been Nazareth. But if his family was right there, Nazareth makes sense.
Well, we know that Jesus left Nazareth early on in the chapter. Jesus heals a man with an unclean spirit in Capernaum.
Yeah, but see, that's the question. Is Mark chronological?
Yeah.
Luke tends to be. Mark, maybe not so.
Well, not all of it is chronological, but I believe in chapter 3, we can safely assume that Jesus is in his home, and his adult home is not Nazareth. We know that he goes back to Nazareth to visit his hometown. This is where we get a prophet is not without honor, except for in his own hometown. He teaches in the synagogue there in Nazareth. But this particular account is outside of the synagogue in Capernaum in Jesus's home, which is his adult home. This would have been the same setting of where the four men bring their friend and tear the roof off the house. This is Jesus's room in Peter's home on the northern shore of Capernaum.
Okay.
And so this is this similar place. Now, the crowds are so large that they can't even eat, that Jesus can't catch a break. They're bringing him people to heal. This is the healing in Mark chapter 3 of the man with the withered right hand. And we see that Jesus is almost, the only other place we see this kind of disregard of someone coming to you is Elijah. Remember with Elijah and Naaman? And Naaman comes to Elijah for a healing.
Advice.
He's got leprosy.
A cure.
He's covered in it. And Elijah the prophet of God, doesn't go out to greet the king.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big deal in this culture. This is an honor-shame culture. Hospitality is key.
It's mandatory.
Absolutely. And not only that, but you get the Ten Commandments that say, honor your father and your mother that your days might be long. And then Jesus drops this, he or she who does the will of my Father in heaven is my mother, my brother, and my sisters. Mm. Here in John chapter 3, Mark chapter 3, it is John chapter 3 because this is John Mark. That's his full
good
name.
Point.
I guess
yeah.
I could say that, but then it would get confusing, wouldn't it?
Now there would be people shaking their heads out there. But
Right. This is John Mark. We believe that John Mark is not one of the 12 disciples. This isn't one of the 12, but this is the assistant of Paul and Barnabas. This is the one who ran away, fled without clothes on at the in the Garden of Gethsemane scene.
Just a very young man. He was probably who could guess 14, 15, 16, and a nephew of Barnabas, was it?
A cousin, yeah.
A cousin, okay.
A relationship with Barnabas, the son of encouragement. And that's relevant because on June the 11th, just on Tuesday, we remembered Barnabas the apostle. That's actually a day in the church of Barnabas the martyr. It's in red. And we remembered Barnabas, the son of encouragement. And so, yes, John Mark is his relative. And so there's a relationship here with them. And John Mark is Peter's scribe. This is the shortest gospel written. It was probably the first gospel written around 55.
I've heard, and maybe you can dispel this false notion if that's what it is, but I had read at one point that Mark had probably accompanied Peter to Babylon at that point, the mid-40s AD, where the book of Mark was first composed or at least considered and maybe written. So that would make it the first one. Mm. And that would be logical because it seems like Matthew,
Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John.
Well, Luke probably would have referred to the book of Mark as Matthew apparently did. So even though Matthew was listed first in the New Testament, chronologically, Mark probably came first.
Yeah, that's right. And originally they thought that Matthew's gospel was first, but now the scholarship is overwhelming. The older manuscripts that we have of Mark, and it does look like both, all three of the synoptics, Luke and Matthew in particular, are using Mark's gospel. So this is where we get the similar accountings. And then there's this mysterious Q source, which I don't believe exists. It's just how the author's writing. Well, if you've got John Mark's gospel and you want to develop your own gospel, if you're Matthew, you're an eyewitness. There's your Q source. There's your other, quote, other source. And same with Luke. If we know that Luke is a physician, that he's hired by Theophilus to write this account, and Luke tells us why he writes his account. I'm writing to you, O excellent Theophilus, to give this orderly account of Jesus of Nazareth. So you've got three different gospel authors with three different purposes writing specifically, and they're using what they know and what's been written and what they have before them, which again is probably Mark's gospel.
Well, here's another thought, because Luke said that he thoroughly investigated the matters at hand and wrote of them, but he was not a participant in Jesus' day-to-day teaching for those 3.5 years. Matthew, or Levi, probably knew Mark personally and experienced some of the same things together. I'm not sure how frequently Mark may have been with the group of disciples and traveling with Jesus. It's hard to believe that he was not a common sight around those people. But Luke would not have known him, because by the time Luke came along, John, Mark, that is Mark, and Barnabas were off in Cyprus. A wholly different pursuit there, and who knows where they went from there.
But again, with Luke's gospel, we do know he's interviewing eyewitnesses. So while he wasn't his quote source, in this case, he would say, what's the Q source? Mark and what else is forming Matthew and Luke? Well, what if it's Matthew and Luke?
Well, I mean, that would have been part of it. The others were still alive. Peter was still around, and James, brother of Jesus, was there. He would have had some stories to tell. I wish, did we know of any writings from James, the brother of Jesus, that James?
The half-brother of Jesus, James, wrote James, the epistle. We have the book of James in the New Testament, but that's pretty much it. Okay. But again, that's another half-brother of Jesus, meaning they share the same mother, but not the same father, because God is the father of Jesus.
Well, correct, yeah.
But again, to the Catholic teaching of Mary's perpetual virginity, and again, they'll say, well, that's Joseph's son, you know, not Mary's. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to some of my more Anglo-Catholic friends about this and have heard them out. I'm unconvinced that Mary is perpetually a virgin. I'm unconvinced of it. I have a more Protestant view. But this is radical, because you can juxtapose like this scene in Mark where Jesus's mother and brothers are outside. And he says, you know, they come and tell him, hey, your mother and brothers are outside. And he says, he who does the will of my father and my mother and brothers and sisters. And we get the impression he doesn't go out and greet them. Later, he adds sisters, by the way. There's no mention that, like, hey, your sisters are outside. Just your mother and your brothers are outside. And then later in chapter 3, when Jesus' response, he adds sisters, almost, I think, just to implicate everyone else to, hey, if you obey my father, if you keep my word, you are my mother's brothers and sisters. So how is that possible that I'm Jesus's mother or brother or sister? It's a new familial connection that Jesus is labeling here, while simultaneously seemingly dishonoring or disregarding his actual mother and brothers that are outside the house.
You know, we take that comment, because it's in the Bible, they said he is out of his mind. Right. We take it seriously. They meant it. Well, that may not be the case. I mean, it could have been a smile and a wink. It could have been just a pleasantry. It could have been they were kidding about Jesus. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, and again, here's the crux of the matter. It's their motivation for being outside that door. It's not to visit him. It's to squelch him. Now, think about Jesus' words with Simon Peter when they're at Caesarea Philippi, and Jesus says, who do people say that I am? And Peter comes out with an A++ answer. Some say John the Baptist, some say one of the prophets. And Jesus says, well, who do you say that I am? And Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And then there's this rejoicing, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, flesh and blood has not revealed this to you. And I'm going to give you the keys, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Upon this truth, this rock of this truth, I'm going to build my church. And then the very next scene is Jesus is saying, I'm going to go die. And then Jesus calls him Satan. He says, get behind me, Satan. So how quick the tables turn. And the same here, if you juxtapose this account with Jesus's mother, with John 2, let's say the wedding of Cana of Galilee, and Mary says, do whatever he tells you to do. And clearly you see that she sees that he is who he says he is and says, hey, they're running out of wine. Do something. Mm-hmm. And he uses a term of endearment. Woman, what does this have to do with me? Well, now she's participating in the kingdom work. But in Mark 4, we actually see her, along with the relatives, thinking Jesus is out of his mind.
Well, see, I think that could have been as if to say, there he goes again. Because yeah. Jesus, no doubt, was a very different kind of child to raise. We don't know much about that. There are some strange, non-biblical written accounts of things that he did in his childhood, which are spurious and considered not factual. But I think it's wrong for us to conclude that they really thought he was out of his mind.
No, I think they were. I mean, that's one way of looking at it. I actually believe they think he's out of his mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they're worried about the hubbub. Because remember, all of this is in the shadow of the scribes and the Pharisees keeping an account.
Would they think that he's putting himself in danger?
Yes. They're worried. They're worried about his reputation. They're worried about what everybody is saying. They're worried about...
After his presentation at the synagogue in Nazareth?
I don't know where that's falling in particular.
Well, because in chapter 3, it talks about Jesus. He was in a synagogue, probably, I'm not sure which synagogue, where the man with a shriveled right hand. Then a crowd.
That's Capernaum.
He withdrew with his disciples to a lake. A large crowd from Galilee followed. That had to be.
That's Capernaum. Yep.
Okay, at Capernaum. And then he went up on a mountainside, called him. That to me says it's the Beatitudes. It's his manifesto, his statement to not only the Pharisees but to the common people of Israel. And immediately after that, he would have gone to Nazareth. I don't think Mark has an account of the synagogue in Nazareth, does he?
Right. Right off the bat, I don't think he does.
Well, if he did, Jesus was threatened with death at Nazareth in that synagogue. That would give his family concern for his safety, wouldn't it?
Sure. So, well, just what we talked about earlier in Mark 3 is Jesus is healing on the Sabbath. His, quote, disregard of the Sabbath is enough. And this is the thing that has everybody. Remember the disciples? We talked about this last week. The disciples were picking the heads of the grain. Mm-hmm. And Jesus says, you're going to kill me just like you killed the
priest. Which in Luke is just before this account of the synagogue, the healing.
Right. So this is on the heels, this Jesus's mother and brother coming to get their boy, so to speak. This is after Jesus is radically violated the Sabbath according to the Pharisees. He's claimed to be a greater king than David. He's aligned himself with the priest in the tabernacle who gave David bread at the cost of their own life.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying, I'm the greater king, I'm the greater priest. And he's saying he's Lord of the Sabbath.
By
he's
golly, he must be out of his mind.
Yeah, he's saying he's the Messiah here. Mm-hmm. And so, by the way, Son of Man is his title in Mark's gospel. It comes up over and over again.
Borrowed from the book of Daniel.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a messianic title. It's Jesus' favorite title for himself. And so in chapter 2, he's just claimed to be Lord of the Sabbath. In Mark chapter 2. In Mark chapter 3, he heals this man with the withered hand on the Sabbath day. Then this huge crowd is following him. And remember, these Pharisees and these religious leaders went out. In verse 6 of chapter 3 says, the Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how they might destroy him or how they might kill him. Now, if you're Jesus's family, what are you going to do? You want your family member out of harm's way.
Hmm.
You don't want him to get killed for the things that he's doing and saying. And Jesus is more concerned with obedience to his Father and doing the kingdom work in front of him than he is about his own life. And that, by default, the application there is, if we want to be in line with God, if we want to be his mother, brother, and sister, we'll do the will of the Father. And so this is why the very next thing that happens is he talks about blasphemy against the Holy Spirit, which is refusing God, refusing to believe God, refusing to receive God, refusing to obey God. And then you've got this incident with the mother and the brothers coming. And then you've got the kingdom parables in Mark chapter 4. So Jesus starts talking about a greater kingdom and a greater purpose. And he begins to say that the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. It's the smallest of seeds you plant it, the birds of the air come and nest in its branches. So Jesus is concerned with another kingdom, and his mother, rightfully so. I mean, gosh, wouldn't your mother just do anything to protect you? Wouldn't your siblings and relatives just do anything to keep you safe and alive? I know my mom would. She's still living. I'm blessed to have her with me. That woman would do anything. She'd lay down on the tracks. She would take a bullet. She would intercede. She would come try to protect. I mean, you've heard of the expression helicopter parent.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a new one, snowplow parent. Remove all the obstacles, you know?
Yep.
And so here we see Mary, maybe not in her best moment. And I love Mary, the mother of Jesus. As a matter of fact, she preached one of the greatest sermons ever in John's gospel. Do whatever he tells you to do. Mary is to be revered. She's to be not worshiped, but reverenced. She's to be honored. She's to be given her due place. But make no mistake, she's a human. And here she makes a human mistake. She's thinking about an earthly kingdom, just like Peter in Caesarea Philippi, where he says, by no means, I'm not going to let you go and die. It won't happen on my watch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Mary's doing here.
I'm reminded of another story, and this would indicate something of the relationship of Jesus with his brothers when they were going to the festival in at the temple in Jerusalem. And they invited him or asked if he was going, and he said, no, it's not my time yet. But then he stealthily went without their knowledge. So he's already doing the kingdom's business when they expect him to be little brother Jesus or older brother Jesus. I'm not sure how that falls into their ages. But
well, look at Luke chapter 2. When Jesus is 12, the only thing we know about his adolescence is he's at the temple.
Mm-hmm.
What does he tell his parents? Like, why are you doing this to us? He says, didn't you know I'd be about my Father's business? And it says that Mary treasures these things in her heart. But in this Mark chapter 3 account, she might have just briefly forgot that happened. you know,
and incidentally, another minor point, maybe not a minor point, but the Bible tells us he was 12.
Yeah.
Which is bar mitzvah time, which is
the
step into manhood. So he didn't waste any time.
Well, and again, that's why he's lost. Is he with mom or dad?
Mm-hmm.
Each of them are assuming, Mary's assuming my boy is with his dad. He's coming of age. And then Joseph's assuming, he's still a youngster. He's with the women in the caravan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only when they get together miles down the road that they realize, I don't have him. Do you have him? And of course, when they go back to Jerusalem, there he is about his Father's business. And he even says to them, don't you know that I'd be about my Father's business? And that's exactly what Jesus is doing in Mark's gospel in chapter 3, when he claims to be Lord of the Sabbath, 3, when he heals the man with the withered right hand, and also when the crowd follows and he says, he who does the will of my Father is my mother, my brother, and his sister. And that's in the end of Mark chapter 3. He's about his Father's business. He's about kingdom work in the world, which is why Mark 4 goes right into the kingdom parables, the parable of the sower, the purpose of the parables, the lamp that sets up on a lamp post. They think he's out of his mind, and he is by world standards. Let's be honest. Is Jesus going to get himself killed with all this? Absolutely. But he's doing a different work. We don't understand it. It doesn't look normal. If we're honest with ourselves, we wouldn't make these decisions. These aren't popular. These aren't popular things that we should be doing, provoking the religious leaders, provoking the power structures of the day. No, Jesus is about a whole nother kingdom work. He has another agenda entirely. Even his mother doesn't understand it. And here she has a moment of protecting her boy when really all he wants to do is die for her.
Parables were a favorite method of teaching of Jesus and of rabbis generally, I would presume. Do you suppose that these are all original parables with Jesus? Or I think some stories like the Good Samaritan story, some scholars think actually happened, that it was a story taken from actual events because it's logical. It was a dangerous place to travel in. But these are all kind of mystical things. I think my own opinion, for what it's worth, is these came straight from Jesus. I think they were gifts to him from the Spirit.
Yeah, I believe the connection of the natural accounting and happenings, I think that does happen, just like the mustard seed. It is the smallest of seeds. Mm-hmm. It does grow up in the biggest of trees where the birds of the air nest. That is true. But Jesus's connection with this reality and the coming kingdom reality, that the kingdom of heaven is like, this is new. This is what Jesus is attaching.
Well,
this is what parable means.
These are points that nobody else had any connection to. I mean, this was all brand new stuff to that culture.
Yeah.
And it was radically different from their day-to-day lives. And even today, I think maybe we're equally confused by them because they're new to us too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the kingdom is this huge concept that we can't get our heads around necessarily. I define the kingdom of God as the rule and reign of God on the earth. So it's all things as God has intended them to be. And so we believe that God's kingdom is here. We believe that it's coming. And so it's the soon and coming king. It's the already and not yet. And so Jesus shows up on the scene 2,000 years ago, and he wants people to understand it. So how do you get them to understand something that's hard to understand? You give them something that's easy to understand, and you connect the two. And that's parable. It's throwing one truth alongside of another truth to make your point. So everyone had a lamp in their house. So this idea that you can't hide your lamp under a basket, this is a kingdom reality. The parable of a seed, this in an agricultural society, everyone understands seeds and harvesting and planting.
See, you're taking me back to the Trinity discussion we had a couple of weeks ago. Now it's about a kingdom that is already, but not yet. Robbie, I'm working on this. I'm just working on it. That's all. Yeah.
Me too. I'm a work in progress.
Robbie, thanks very much. Broken Road Radio. It's just tickled to have Robbie with us every week. He, again, and the executive director of Preserving Bible Times, their website, preservingbibletimes.org. You got to take a look at that site to see what there is to offer. It's contextual information. It's the stuff that helps you read between the lines of the gospel accounts and the Bible generally. You would be blessed by taking a look at it. Robbie, we'll look forward to next week.
Joy and a privilege to be with you, Jim, on the Broken Road. Pleasure as always. Thanks for having me on.
Blessings. Bye-bye.